facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A marvelous Monday to you. Hashtag Maverick Monday on The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. So glad to be with you today. So glad to be back. Hey, we don't have Pledge Drive music this week, which is kind of awesome. But Pledge Drive was great. I'm not knocking Pledge Drive at all because you guys knocked it out of the park. We had to raise $2.7 million for Relevant Radio to keep on the air and keep this fine programming going. I guess you can decide how fine this is after the show, but you guys blew us away. We exceeded our expectations. We actually raised even more than that. I don't know what the final tally is, but thank you. Thank you so much for your generosity. Thank you so much. And because of that, we don't have to talk about Pledge Drive stuff this week, which is great. And we can get our regular tunes back, our regular intro song back. I'm super excited about that. And I want you to call me. There's a couple phone lines open, so it's a great chance to get through. If you have something you want to talk about, a question you want to ask, call 1-888-914-9149. That's our toll-free studio line here at the Cale Clark Show, 1-888-914-9149. You can also email us, cale@relevantradio.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. We also have a show account, at Cale Clark Show. Lucas, our producer, put up an interesting poll on the show account earlier, which was, is it too early to start playing Christmas music? I know what my answer is. What's yours? We'll see what the poll results are later on. But, you know, lots to talk about. Now, I'm excited about this week. I'm in a good mood. I'm in a good mood, even though it's Monday, back to work, back to the grind. I'm in a really good mood. I'm optimistic about the future. Maybe you're not, but I am. I really am. You know, hey, listen, you know, God is still in control. And there's been a lot of talk about the political process and what's happening now, and a lot of talk about, you know, women gaining political office, which I think is great. Fantastic. I want to tell you about some women who have gained political office that you might not have heard about in the news cycle, because they're focusing on some other things. But Christianity Today magazine, I tweeted out a profile of these women recently. I also did it today, but a couple days ago I did it too. Christianity Today magazine, which is it's like kind of like the Time magazine of the evangelical world, did this story a couple of days ago where they talked about these ladies. 13 new pro-life women have been elected to the House of Representatives during the elections last week. Not bad. Not too shabby at all. In fact, they join 11 incumbent pro-life women who are already part of the House of Representatives who were reelected. So now there are 20. Oh, man. How's my math? 24. Yeah. I was sick.
You are correct, sir. Yeah.
Yeah, I was sick the day they taught math at school, but still got that one right. Took me a couple seconds, but hey, I'm slow on the draw. That's fine. So, really interesting piece in Christianity Today about these women. And actually, there are some more pro-life candidates who are running in 8 more House races that have not yet been called. I don't know if you heard, but some political races are still in question. And that's all I'm going to say about that. But these 8 House races have not been called either. And so there might even be more ladies in the House who are pro-life. So that's fantastic news. And in fact, in 2020, 107 women were elected to the House, and that surpasses the previous record set last time, which was 102. 102. Apparently, there were some elections in 19 as well. And 102 were elected then. There are now 107 women. And this is actually great because, rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly, the truth of the matter is this. If men are pro-life advocates in government, and there's nothing wrong with that, and this bias simply should not exist. In a perfect world, it wouldn't exist. But the fact of the matter is that when men advocate for the rights of the unborn in government, sometimes people don't want to listen to them. Sometimes their views are dismissed out of hand. Why? Because people will say, well, you don't understand because you're not a woman. You don't understand what it's like to get pregnant. You're not personally involved with it. So, is that a good argument? Not necessarily, of course, but the fact of the matter is, to the other side, they will often dismiss arguments out of hand if they come from a man. So it's good for women to be represented here, because you can never say to them, oh, you don't understand what it's like to give birth, or you don't understand what it's like to be a woman. Okay, that takes one excuse out of the arsenal of pro-abortion advocates in the United States. And Carol Tobias, who is the president of the National Right to Life Foundation, said, quote, bringing in more pro-life women will give encouragement and support to the leaders who have been speaking up for years, end of quote. Now, all of the pro-life representatives who were elected this week to the House, they're all Republican ladies. They're all Republicans. And a lot of them say that their position on this comes from their faith. And we'll talk about that in just a second. But, you know, it's just so interesting to me that, you know, the Democrats are so entrenched as the party of death. I mean, there may be one or two out there somewhere. Maybe you guys can enlighten me on this, but I don't know of any Democratic candidate running for office in these times who is pro-life. And I just think that, I mean, I guess they're, you know, if any of them ever did come out as pro-life, they might, kicked out of the party and that's certainly the case up here in Canada, by the way. The Liberal Party of Canada, you are not allowed, basically, to take a pro-life position in that party, and they're the ruling party up here in Canada. And I just think, you know, man, like, there's so many people who would never vote for the Democrats because of that issue, no matter what they say about anything else. And I just don't understand why they have to be so entrenched as the party of death. I guess they're afraid they'll lose all the pro-death people, pro-abortion votes, if any of them were ever to switch. But anyways, this is part of the deep divide that's going on in America right now. But this is really interesting that these ladies did gain office and they won positions in the House. And 7 out of these 13 new pro-life women in the House, they actually flipped seats that were previously held by Democrats, including Nancy Mace. Nancy Mace, and she looks like she carries a mace. She was able to beat her opponent with a mace. No, she didn't do that. But she did defeat the incumbent Joe Cunningham in South Carolina's 1st congressional district. And Nancy Mace is actually a 42-year-old single mother of two. And she's going to be the first Republican woman to represent the 1st congressional district. So congratulations to her. And she actually mentioned in her, you know, platform that she believes the right to life is given by God. So a lot of them are very, very upfront about where their pro-life beliefs come from. It comes from their faith. Now, it's interesting, too, because you don't necessarily need to be a person of faith. Now, it obviously helps, because they're right about that. They're right about that. Our rights, our human dignity come ultimately from God. But even somebody who is not a person of faith should be able to, just from science alone and from the concept of human rights alone, be able to argue for defense of unborn life. But so one need not be a person of faith to take that view. But of course, you know, our faith is true, and it is a top-down approach for sure. And so obviously Christianity Today, being an evangelical magazine, focused a lot on the evangelical faith of some of these folks. Diana Harshberger was another victor in this contest, a pharmacist from Kingsport, Tennessee, and she won 76% of the vote to serve Tennessee's 1st congressional district. And she was a Sunday school teacher for 25 years, and again, she says that her pro-life position comes from her faith. Mary Miller, a new representative for Illinois' 15th congressional district, said, "My family and my faith in God always come first." She was also a Sunday school teacher, and she attends an evangelical church in Oakland, Illinois. So this is very, very common that there are people of faith involved with this group of women. There you have it. And you know what? And lots of different faith groups were voting for these ladies, not just other evangelicals, but obviously Catholics too, obviously. Many Methodists, many Mormons, even Mormons were voting for people like Florida Representative-elect Kat Kamick. She's going to be the youngest Republican woman ever in the House at age 32, and she had a wide swath of support from all kinds of religious groups in her district when she launched a faith and pro-life coalition. So, kind of cool. And if you want more on this issue, You should definitely go back in the archives and listen to the interview I did with Stephanie Gray Connors, who's a pro-life advocate who's debated at Google in California on the issue of abortion, given talks on that, debated Peter Singer, who is a notorious pro-abortionist very recently. That was set up by Harvard. You should go check that out. I interviewed her last Thursday. That was a great show. So check that out. And so there's a lot of takeaways here from this. And my producer, Lucas Holt, gave me a little bit of a civics lesson on this, which I appreciated a lot. And one of the things that Lucas said was that regardless of who is in the Oval Office, the president is not really a lawmaker. And somebody could actually argue it's more influential to have members in Congress who are pro-life, since they're the ones that can actually draft legislation to protect the unborn. Now, obviously, a president can veto any kind of legislation like that, but Congress could override a veto with a two-thirds majority vote. So in a sense, that's in some ways even more important. And, you know, it's not like the numbers are in our favor right now in terms of the pro-life cause, but things are looking up. The Supreme Court justices, Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, who were recently appointed, give some hope that maybe down the line we could see some restrictions, at least, on abortion in the United States. So, you know, but ultimately, as Lucas also said when we were talking about this, you know, God is ultimately the one that moves the needle in human history. And so we've got to pray. We've got to keep praying. And we've got to understand that, you know, this may take some time. The abolition of abortion is going to come maybe at a place that we don't expect and in a way that we don't expect. But it ultimately will come about because it's profoundly unjust. So there you have it. Some really good news from the political arena. In the midst of a lot of other news that we're dealing with these days. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show, and you can give me a call if you want to react to that. Call in 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call for that toll-free studio line. So congratulations, ladies, these new House representatives. You rock the vote. Good for you. Good for you. Good for you. Well, you know, I can't believe it's been only 10 days since the Dodgers won the World Series. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to get into an extended discussion on sports, but if you're a Dodger fan out in LA, if you're listening, or somewhere in Southern California, or really anywhere around the country, around the world, lots of Dodger fans out there. And I know there's a lot of people in LA listening to the show because their numbers are through the roof in Southern California, in LA. Do you remember this scene just a few days ago? Listen to Joe Buck on the call.
Dave Roberts. That's strike three. Dodgers have won it all. 2020.
It's Joe Buck on the call for Fox Sports calling the World Series. So yeah, first World Series championship for the Dodgers since 1988. But of course, amidst all the celebrations, there was, as you might have heard, a little bit of controversy. And that controversy has gotten even more intensified today because, well, we can say this, you know, there's no I in team, but there certainly is in COVID. And there certainly is in the word COVIDiot. In fact, there are two I's there, at least. So there are apparently now 9 positive COVID-19 cases affiliated with the LA Dodgers organization, according to a spokesperson for the LA County Department of Public Health. And it's up to 9. It was 5 just a couple of days ago on Friday. It's up to 9 today, at least, and maybe even getting higher. And where is this all coming from? Well, most people are pointing the finger at Justin Turner, the redheaded Dodgers third baseman, you know, he of the flaming beard, red beard, who played amazing for the Dodgers in the series. Just incredible. I don't think they win the World Series without Justin Turner. But as you may have heard, during the clinching game 6, he was pulled somewhere around the 8th inning from the game. A lot of fans are wondering, why did he leave the game? Well, it turns out that he had tested positive for COVID-19. And there's still some people wondering when exactly did people know that he was positive? You know, when did the Dodgers know? I haven't seen anything that can indicate that they somehow kept him in the game knowing he was positive. As soon as the result was cleared and verified, he was pulled from the game. The outcome was pretty much secured at that point. But the controversy really ensued because when they won the World Series, when that final out happened, everybody, of course, storms onto the field, players, coaches, you know, wives, girlfriends, officials, photographers, everybody's out there celebrating. And Turner decided to return to the field to celebrate even though he knew he was positive for COVID-19. And MLB, Major League Baseball, has announced that it's not going to punish Turner for his actions. And they found out through their investigation. I think one of the reasons why they're not punishing him, by the way, is because they're kind of complicit in him getting out there in the first place. Turner apparently thought he had received permission from at least one Dodger employee to join his teammates on the field. And he was actively encouraged, quote unquote, actively encouraged to leave his isolation room and join his teammates for a celebratory photograph, according to Commissioner Rob Manfred, who is far from the most popular commissioner in sports these days. And so Manfred said this. He said, many teammates felt they had already been exposed to Mr. Turner and were prepared to tolerate the additional risk. Turner has, of course, apologized in a statement saying that he's spoken with almost every one of his teammates, coaches, and staff members, and his intentions were never to make anyone uncomfortable or put anyone at further risk. Well, I guess everything's fine then, you know? I'm sorry, I don't buy this at all. I think it's a totally selfish move on the part of Justin Turner, and clearly it is has borne some very bitter fruit. And some people are going to get really sick, and their lives may even be in danger. So I hope it was worth it, Justin. I understand it. I get it. You know, you're winning the World Series. You want to celebrate with your teammates. You've been searching for this, you know, ring for years. And you know, especially in the case of the Dodgers, they've been denied so many times, fairly or unfairly, in the case of their series with Houston. Don't want to dredge that up, Dodger fans. But you know, he's celebrating with his teammates. First, he had a mask on. Then he took it off. And then he's sitting next to manager Dave Roberts, who had Hodgkin's lymphoma. He's an older guy, and he's someone who in the past had Hodgkin's lymphoma. And Dave Roberts once said this about his lymphoma. He said, I'll take beating cancer over any World Series. Baseball is part of me, something I did, but my fight against cancer was real. So the question is, you know, what is real to Justin Turner? You know, holding the trophy, getting a photo op. He chose himself instead of his teammates. So ultimately, you know, in a team sport, he made the ultimate selfish move. And he decided that he had sacrificed enough, so I'm going to put everybody else on the field in harm's way. Other players, coaches. I'm sure he didn't see it this way, but the fact of the matter, he was putting players, coaches, wives, kids that may have been out there, team personnel, support staff, photographers, everybody. People that didn't work for the team who were out there on that field, who had to be there for work purposes. And all of them are at risk now. So, I don't know. I just don't get it. I don't get it. It just boggles my mind out there to think how many people there are out there who don't think COVID is a big deal. It really is. It's incredibly dangerous. I don't know if you caught this story, but, and this is a really sad story. There was a kindergarten student who passed away, died of COVID-19 in northern Texas, in Amarillo. And she was only 5 years old. She was only 5 years old. I don't know if you caught this story over the weekend, but she was actually herself very, you know, cognizant about COVID and was going to school. And she would always wear a mask, and she would even remind her mom to wear her mask if she forgot to wear it when she went out. And at some point last week, she became very sleepy and began vomiting. She was brought by her parents to the emergency department, and she tested positive for COVID-19. Now, the doctor said she's going to be fine. This virus doesn't really affect kids. Well, sadly, she stopped breathing and died shortly afterwards. She died within 15 hours of being diagnosed. And so, admittedly, this is rare. It is rare for a child to die of COVID, but it is possible. And this is no joke. This is no joke at all. So, anyways, be careful out there and be safe. That's all I can say. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Give me a call, 1-888-914-9149. I know that was kind of a sad story there to talk about, but we will talk about brighter things after this break. So we'll be back really shortly on the program.
is The Kale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Please pray for the family of that little girl who passed away from COVID. And speaking of people who passed away, we can pray for the repose of their souls. A Canadian icon and an American icon as well. Alex Trebek, unfortunately, passed away very, very recently, just a few hours ago. Wow. You know, he'd been sick for some time. And obviously, he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And he thought he had beaten that, but that is just an incredibly difficult and dogged disease to try to defeat, and he succumbed to it. So really, we could say, you know, hey, the greatest game show host in history, who is Alex Trebek? And of course, many of you are fans of Jeopardy, and a lot of people don't know that Alex Trebek had a Catholic background. Did you know that? Did you know that? And he was actually given a major award from Fordham University in the New York City area, the Fordham Founders Award. And this happened actually before COVID hit. This was back in January. And this accolade is given to individuals whose personal and professional lives reflect the highest aspirations of Fordham University's traditions, an institution dedicated to wisdom and learning in the service of others. And in fact, Father Joseph McShane, who is the president of Fordham University, when he was giving Trebek the Founders Award, he called him the nation's school teacher because, you know, in his 36 years, I can't even believe that, 36-year stint hosting Jeopardy, you know, basically, you know, Alex Trebek, you know, encouraged education through that program. I don't know about you, but that's certainly true for me. It made me want to learn things and be as smart as Ken Jennings, shall we say. And even though at that time, this was back in January, as I said, he'd been obviously battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer for some time, he came out in person with his wife Jean to the ceremony to accept the award. And here's what he said when he was talking to the crowd about the importance of prayer.
I get a lot of perks because of my work. Recently, Jeannie and I, on Christmas Day, as a matter of fact, took the family to the Lakers-Clippers game. And while I was there, I went over, took a moment to say hello to Mike Breen, the announcer for ESPN. And it was interesting. We greeted each other, we hugged each other, and he leaned over to me and he said, "Remember, Alex, there are a lot of people praying for you, and prayer has a lot of power. And if there's one thing I have discovered in the past year, it is that power of prayer. I learned it from the Jesuits when I was a kid. I learned it from the Oblates of Mary Immaculate when I was in boarding school and at college. If you have compassion in your heart, everything is possible. Peace everywhere is possible."
That's beautiful words from Alex Trebek. And there were 275 people in that room, and they all prayed the Lord's Prayer for him after that. I mean, I'm sure there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And wow, so a lot of people don't know that he went to a Catholic boarding school growing up in Canada. And whether or not he was fully practicing his Catholic faith, that we're not sure. But do pray for the repose of his soul for sure. And anyways, at that ceremony, when he received the Fordham University Founders Award, he was given a 20-pound statue. That's what you get when you win this. It's a statuette of the founder of Fordham University, Archbishop John Hughes. And he is in the statue. He's wearing his bishop's cope or cape, if you will. And here's what Alex Trebek had to say about that.
"People ask me at the studio quite often, if you weren't hosting Jeopardy, what would you have wanted to be in your life? And my response for years has been consistent: Pope. I feel I look good in white, and I'm really good at riding, standing up in open vehicles and waving to people and doing this kind of stuff. Okay? So."
Okay. That was great stuff. Very, very funny stuff from Alex Trebek. And we need to pray for the repose of his soul. So in your kindness, please, I hope you will do that as well. Now, our own Patrick Alog, who's screening calls for us tonight on the Cale Clark Show. Patrick, you at one point tried out to be a contestant on Jeopardy, right?
I guess it depends on what you mean by try out. It was actually for College Jeopardy, and I thought I would do really well. It was a 50-question test. I thought I got like 35 to 40, correct? I didn't even make the first cut.
No way.
No.
Wow.
And also to this day, I still take the Jeopardy online test, and that the regular Jeopardy is hard to get on. So, mm-hmm. You know, my dream was to become go on Jeopardy, maybe meet Alex Trebek in person. Obviously, you know, that's not going to happen. But, you know, still, I'm going to still take the Jeopardy online test. You never know if I'll make it.
Yeah, I'm going to pray for you, man. I think you can do it. I think you can do it, man. Just
I don't know. If they ask me about Shakespeare and science, no. Those are like my two, yeah. Don't ask me about Shakespeare. Don't ask me about science.
All right. Well, try to avoid those categories for sure. Hopefully somebody else picks those on the board when you get on. But anyway, so that's kind of cool. Yeah. How, man, Jeopardy tryouts. How good do you have to be to get through those? Man, unbelievable. Well, Patrick, you do have this this consolation. The Dodgers did win the World Series, and I know you're drinking coffee out of your Dodgers cup right now,
yes,
which
I
you
am.
Have at Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I am.
And, you know. You should wash it every once in a while. Don't let those rings, you know, go around the cup.
I
know?
Do.
But
I do.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. That's good to know. Hey, listen. Wow, lots of people to pray for. But here's someone else you should pray for. And this is, I guess, at some level, a troubling story. Did you know that there was a woman who was recently arrested in Georgia for claiming that she is an FBI agent, and as a result, she is entitled to free Chick-fil-A for life. Yes, Fox News is reporting that authorities arrested a woman in a place called Dallas, Georgia. I didn't know that there was a place called Dallas, Georgia, after she allegedly tried to convince restaurant workers that she was, in fact, an FBI agent and should get, you know, free chicken sandwiches, free waffle fries. And anyways, for some reason, the people working at that particular Chick-fil-A didn't buy her story. And they called 911, and things went even more downhill after that. I mean, I'm just kind of thinking, like, how in character do you have to be, you know, to like to actually think you can get away with this, you know? Now, maybe she wasn't in her right mind. I don't know. I have no idea. But pray for her at any rate. So, you know, this is not the first time. Apparently, she's tried to do this before, and she has threatened to arrest employees when they don't provide the food. You know, hey, I work for the FBI, you know, hand over those waffle fries right now. Don't make me call Commissioner Gordon. Come on. So, I mean, if you're the employee, if you're the Chick-fil-A employee behind the counter, you have to think like, well, if I don't give her the food, you know, how bad could it be? What would the charges be? You know, failing to provide chicken sandwiches to a federal officer upon request? I mean, I don't know. Anyways, so when the police came, this lady, and her name again was Kimberly George Ragsdale. Ragsdale reportedly continued to claim that this was all a big misunderstanding and she is, in fact, a federal agent. And she told officers, listen, the reason why I don't have a badge or any FBI ID is because all my credentials are electronic only. Oh, why didn't you say so? You're free to go.
Alrighty.
You're free to go. No, she wasn't free to go. They put her in handcuffs. They arrested her. But she reportedly was pretending to talk into a radio in her shirt, and she was trying to alert her fellow FBI agents that she was, in fact, being arrested and that the FBI needed to send backup immediately to Chick-fil-A to get her out of this jam. So I'm sure they waited patiently for her backup to arrive just in case. Anyways, the Rockmart Police Chief Randy Turner said, and I quote, "We are thankful for the observant and professional staff at Chick-fil-A who knew what to do and gathered the info needed for us to make our case and catch her in the act. We would like to inform our citizens to call 911 if someone is claiming to be an officer, if they aren't in a marked car or in a proper uniform, or if they don't have the proper credentials," end of quote. So she was formally charged with impersonating a public officer. And the good news for her is that there is lots and lots of free food in prison. what's she going to do with that one phone call? Hey, Uber Eats, hi, could you slide by Chick-fil-A for me? Do you deliver to the big house? Anyways, Great story, but I don't blame her, man. Like, Chick-fil-A is pretty addictive. It's pretty addictive. And in fact, I don't know if you've heard this song, but it's one of my favorites.
Chick-fil-A. I could eat there 7 times a day, where the people laugh and children play. Oh, I'm in love with Chick-fil-A. Suddenly, I need waffle fries in front of me, with some nuggets and a large sweet tea. Oh, Chick-fil-A, you set me free. Kids, get in the van so we can go there today. But their stores are closed, oh, I know, 'cause it's Sunday. Chick-fil-A. What a dirty, rotten trick to play. Now I have to settle for Subway. Oh, I'm in love with Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A.
All right. That was Tim Hawkins, Christian comedian and singer. Very well done. Very well done. That's a great, great tune set to Yesterday, of course, from the Beatles. And I was always teased by Patrick Madrid for not liking the Beatles enough. Anyways, but apparently, according to Patrick Alog here, Chick-fil-A is very far away from the studio, from the Relevant Radio studio in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It's nearly 30 miles away, but producer Lucas made sure when he moved to the area that he lived right down the street from the Chick-fil-A. So, Lucas, congratulations. That's great. That's awesome.
Thanks, Gail. Appreciate that.
You know, Chick-fil-A actually came to Canada, by the way, very recently, and I'm so excited about that because I just
love right?
Chick-fil-A. Yeah, Chick-fil-A's
in Canada?
Chick-fil-A finally came to Canada. So there are now two locations in the Toronto area, and they're both, like, just packed all day long, every day. I mean, when they first opened up, there was literally, I tried to go there, I gave up. As good as Chick-fil-A is, I wasn't going to wait in a lineup for 3 hours. I mean, it was just all around the block, and there were protesters. Yeah, there were protesters who were, you know, dressed in chicken outfits and, you know, animal rights after it. Anyways, it was a mess, but I didn't go. I still haven't gone. So, but apparently Popeyes has a competitor out there in the space now, the Popeyes chicken sandwich. This is not exactly what you wanted to tune in to listen to when you're tuning into Relevant Radio, you know, which chicken sandwich is the best. But anyways, I haven't had the Popeyes one, so let me know if that's any good. There is a Popeyes around the corner, and it's, I can probably get in there. So let me know. 1-888-914-9149 is the toll-free studio line for the Cale Clark Show. Hey, by the way, today's a pretty interesting feast day in the Catholic Church. Speaking of feasting, you know, on Chick-fil-A or Popeyes, we have a lot of feasts in the Catholic Church. Practically every day is a feast in the Catholic Church. There are so many great saints. And today is an interesting feast day because it is the feast of a church and of a chair. The feast of a chair, yes. It is the feast day of the dedication of the St. John Lateran Basilica in Rome. And by the way, just so you know, as someone who I follow on Twitter, Josh McManaway, who's a postdoctoral person who's involved at the McGrath Institute at Notre Dame, total sidebar, Notre Dame, talk about super spreader events when they beat Clemson on Saturday night. And Karen Moran just texted us about this in our internal communications. You probably saw this on TV. The students absolutely, you know, rushed the field. It was just insane. They were not social distancing, let's put it that way. I'm assuming cases are going to go up in South Bend. But anyways, Josh McManaway, who did his PhD at Notre Dame, doing some postdoctoral work there with the McGrath Institute, he said, hey guys, just so you know, St. John Lateran is not an actual dude, okay? There is no saint named St. John Lateran. This is actually a feast day for the St. John Lateran Basilica in Rome. This is actually the oldest church in the world, the oldest church in the Catholic Church. And by the way, this is the location of the cathedra, or the teaching chair of the Pope. It's not St. Peter's in Rome. The Pope's cathedral, and that's where his cathedra is, or his chair, is in fact the St. John Lateran Basilica in Rome. A lot of Catholics didn't know that. A lot of Catholics don't know that. Well, now you know. Now you know. And every cathedral and every diocese or archdiocese in the world is the mother church of the diocese, because that's where the bishop's chair or the cathedra resides. And in fact, that is why St. John Lateran is in fact the mother church of Rome, not St. Peter's. So, I mean, how about that? So this is it. This is it. What is the connection, by the way, of the feast with today's Mass readings? I don't know if you caught the Mass readings today. They're quite beautiful. The first reading was from the book of Ezekiel, and it talks about the temple of Jerusalem, living waters flowing from the temple in Jerusalem, irrigating the whole earth. This is really a metaphor for the Holy Spirit bringing supernatural life to the world. The source, of course, of this living water is God himself. And his unique dwelling place on earth in the Old Covenant period was, of course, in the temple in Jerusalem. And if you've been listening to our sister program, The Faith Explained, I've been obviously going through the book of Revelation, which is incredibly exciting. And it's all about the end of the world. Well, I mean, that's really happening on two levels. There's the end of the universe that's coming at some point, the second coming of Christ. But there's also the end of another world, and that was the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in the year 70 AD by the Romans. It was destroyed in what Josephus, the historian of the times, the great Jewish historian, called, you know, a blazing inferno, and the temple was destroyed. It was really one of the, it wasn't really one of the official wonders of the world, but it really was one of the wonders of the ancient world, the Herodian temple, the second temple that was constructed by Herod the Great in Jerusalem. And when you go there, of course, you can still see the Western Wall, the only remaining section of Herod's temple. But this thing was just unbelievable. And to the Jews, the temple was a miniature model of the universe. And to them, the universe was one gigantic temple. So when the universe was or when the temple was destroyed, it was like the universe was destroyed. It was like the end of the world. So the temple was really, in a lot of ways, the locus of God's presence in the Old Covenant. But as we learn in the gospel reading today, which was taken from John chapter 2, this is when Jesus says, hey, if you destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it again. They're like, what are you talking about? You know, like, it's taken over 46 years to build this temple. And they obviously thought he was meaning the physical building. But as John tells us in his gospel, Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body, which was, of course, raised again in 3 days in the resurrection. But more so even than that, there is another body of Christ, and that's us. That is the temple of God known as the church, in which we all are living stones. We're all part of that spiritual temple that is built by God. And of course, you're listening to the Cale Clark Show. You can call in 1-888-914-9149 on Relevant Radio if you want to comment on any of this, if you have a question about any of this. But in the sacred humanity of Christ, you could really say that God, you know, one of the centerpieces of the old temple was the tabernacle. And the tabernacle was, I shouldn't say that. The tabernacle was really the precursor to the temple. The tabernacle was kind of the mobile temple in the wilderness that the Israelites used for the ark. And God's presence was there in a special way. And in John's gospel, in the first chapter, in John 1:14, it says that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. One translation of that, you could translate it this way: God pitched his tent or tabernacled among us. That's one way to translate that verse, John 1:14. So this is one of the key points that Jesus was making in the gospel today. He has a mystical body too, of course. There's his physical body, which was resurrected, his mystical body, the church, all the baptized are members of it. Because we've received the Holy Spirit, which was, you know, in a sense, pouring out of the temple in the first reading, we've received the very life of God through the Spirit's action in the sacraments. And as long as we remain in a state of grace, we are temples of God on earth individually. God truly lives within us. And we, in that sense, as Peter tells us, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, we are partakers of the divine nature. We share in God's life because of the sacraments. So this is really why, if we're a temple too, this is why the theology of the body is so important. You know, the second reading today was from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, when Paul says, "Do you not know that you are the temple of God? The Spirit of God dwells in you." If more Catholics realize this, they would fastidiously avoid sin. And, you know, there's a writer named Alexander McLaren who wrote in the 19th century, and he said this, and his words are just as relevant today as they were back then. He said, "Christianity reverences the body and would teach us all that, being robed in that most wonderful work of God's hands, which becomes a shrine for God himself, if he dwell in our hearts." Think about that. Our body becomes a shrine for God himself, if he dwell in our hearts. All purity, all chastisement and subjugation of animal passion is our duty. Drunkenness, gluttony, lusts of every kind, impurity of conduct, impurity of word and look and thought, all of these assume a still darker tint when they are thought of as not only crimes against the moral law of humanity, but insults flung in the face of the God who would inhabit the shrine. Wow, those are powerful words from Alexander McLaren. I'll leave you with that. So yes, St. John Lateran is the mother church, if you will, of the Pope and of the Universal Church, because that's where the Pope's teaching chair resides. And we too are physical temples of the presence of God in our own bodies. Mind-boggling stuff to think about, but we'll be back. You can process that over the break, and we'll be back in just a moment on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters. Information about employment opportunities and their flexible premium life insurance plans is available at relevantradio.com/forester.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, little Paul McCartney and Wings there, you know, because I said once when I was guest hosting the Patrick Madrid show that I actually liked Wings better than the Beatles, and Cyrus just went off. He's Patrick's producer, and anyways, so we're not speaking right now. No, I'm only kidding. No, we're good friends. We're good friends, really good friends. We're all friends here at Relevant Radio. And we're friends with you too, because you're part of the family. You joined the family and responded to our need. We needed to raise $2.7 million in our pledge drive last week, and you guys really came through. Man, above and beyond the call of duty, let me tell you. We needed to raise $2.7 million, and we actually raised, through your generosity, about $2.9, maybe even more, maybe close to $3 million. The accountants are still, the bean counters are still at work. Let's put it that way. They've got their pencils behind their ears and they're counting up everything. And 13,000 of you out there made those donations. So thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of our hearts for joining the family and making great Catholic radio possible. We really appreciate that. And thanks for coming through. And you know, as we are here on Monday, obviously a new work week is starting. And I want to talk to you about something I've been thinking about a lot. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Cal Newport. Cal Newport. Now, this guy just fascinates me. I'd love to get him on the show sometime. Maybe Lucas, you can call him up and see if he wants to come on. But he's written some really interesting books. One of them is called Deep Work, which is fascinating. I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. He's also written another one called So Good They Can't Ignore You, which is actually a line from comedian Steve Martin, you know, be so good that they can't ignore you. And he also has some interesting takes on social media. He does not have a social media account, Cal Newport. And you should check out his TED Talk. He's got a very interesting TED Talk that you can find on YouTube. And it just is called Quit Social Media. It's not a long talk. It's about, you know, maybe 12 or 15 minutes long. Quit Social Media. And he's basically saying that a lot of social media is nothing more than like entertainment. It's some mildly amusing entertainment sites that have had a pretty good run recently. And he's basically saying it's a total waste of your time. It's a total waste of your time. It's an interesting take. It's worth checking out, even if you are into social media. And I don't know, Karen Moran, you should watch this talk. I'd love to hear what you think of this as she is running our Twitter account right now. And check it out. Check it out. It's food for thought. And one of the things that he talks about with respect to work, I want to kind of bring it back to that right now. In his book, Deep Work, he talks about the fact that because of things like the distractions of social media and especially mobile phones that are constantly buzzing and trying to get our attention all the time, especially if we have notifications set up for them to go off anytime someone sends us a message, that we become so addicted to these things and to distraction that we can't get any work of real value done. And he says that a lot of what passes for work, quote unquote, in society right now is nothing but shallow work, as he calls it. It's not deep work. It's you know, oh, I start working on something, and then I get a phone call, and or then I want to check my email, and then oh, somebody messaged me on my phone, got a WhatsApp notification or an iMessage, better check that. Oh, just got a Facebook notification, I better plug in and see what someone has posted. So as a result, or you're, you know, now this isn't happening as much anymore because we're not, you know, in physical offices, but you know, there's all the, always the water cooler distraction, right? There's conversations in the office. There's someone bugging you who's in the next cubicle. So things are a little bit different now because people are using Zoom meetings to connect and they're adjusting to not working in physical office spaces. But I really think he's onto something. He said basically like most of the great stuff that's been accomplished, you know, in human history has been through this deep work, this deep focused work. And he said, actually, like, if you really, really focus in mentally on your task, if you're able to lock in and laser in on something, then actually you can get a lot more done because it won't take you as long if you're more focused on it. And just the quality of it is going to be so much better. And I read an interesting article on this website called Rescue Time. And I don't totally agree with this, but it talks about how if you were able to implement some of these principles, your workday could actually be about 50% shorter. 50% shorter. Does that sound good to you? Well, let's check it out. One of the things that this guy says, and this guy's name is Jory McKay, who's writing this article, he said that, picking up on some ideas from Cal Newport, that the 8-hour workday should not be part of a new normal because almost no one is actually working for 8 hours a day. Now, they probably should be, but chances are, based on data, most people don't work productively for 8 hours a day. In fact, most modern workers are only truly productive for a maximum of 2 hours and 50 minutes a day. Now, that actually kind of shocked me. What about the other five and a half hours? Well, they're usually spent, again, and this is mostly in the older office type environment, but they're usually spent on non-work activities, such as reading the news, social media, socializing with coworkers, taking breaks, multitasking, context switching, and endless meetings. Meetings are great, aren't they? Meetings are great. I'm sure you love being on Zoom because you get to go to more meetings, right? So, and then the other thing, too, is that the quality of our work drops sharply after a certain number of hours. So even if you try to work more, you're distracted a lot during your day, and you try to make up for it later by working longer, your productivity is actually going to hit the wall anyways, because after 50 hours of work in a week, output and creativity sharply declines, according to Stanford University. And the more you work, it gets even worse. So people who try to work a 70-hour work week are likely to produce nothing of any value during those extra 15 to 20 hours. That is interesting. That is really interesting to me. So I'm not so sure you should drop down to, you know, like a 4-hour workday, but the truth of the matter is, studies show that our focus is only limited to blocks of 20 to 90 minutes max, and then you kind of need a break. So I don't know. I want to develop this more in future episodes because we're kind of running out of time here, but something to think about. To be more focused in your work requires more concentration. And that requires getting rid of the distractions, maybe turning off your phone or silencing those notifications for a few hours at least while you're working. Anyway, so check out Cal Newport. Tell me what you think. It's really fascinating stuff. And Lucas, producer Lucas Holt, decided to leave Twitter and go out into the wilderness for a little while. And how's that working for you, Lucas?
You know, I've got to say, Kale, to be honest, I really don't miss being on Twitter all that much. Like, there are some moments where I have FOMO, which is a fear of missing out. But I think that, you know, as I've thought more about this, I think for many of us, there's this temptation to, I need to, quote unquote, be in the know in order to know what's going on or in order to have conversations with people, even with like stuff like evangelization. But I think of somebody like St. John Paul II, who was so in tune with the times and the people that he was around. And I remember reading one time in George Weigel's biography, Witness to Hope, that it wasn't until he was the Archbishop of Krakow that a priest finally came up to him and was like, had to heavily convince him, like, Father, please at least read the newspaper and get a feel for what's going on.
Wow.
And I don't know. I just think that, like, there's definitely a place for it. You know, yeah. There's definitely a place for social media. Like, it's not a good or a bad thing, but I think it's worth evaluating, you know.
Yeah, I think it calls for an ongoing discussion, that is for sure. And one of the things Cal Newport says that he actually reads a physical newspaper. He actually uses an alarm clock as well to wake himself up, because one of the first things that people do, they use their phone as an alarm clock. So as soon as it goes off in the morning, they naturally check their phone because it's in their hands. So they don't like pray first thing. They don't do a morning offering or any other kind of prayer. They go right to the phone, right to the social media apps, and they're locked in. And that's not necessarily a great way to start the day. Anyways, this is an interesting conversation. We've got to continue this later on, but we have unfortunately run out of time for today, but it's so good to be back with you. This is Cale Clark. I really want to thank my producer, Lucas Holt. By the way, he's still kind of on Twitter because he runs my show account along with Karen Moran. So if you're on the show account, you can basically talk to Lucas that way. So he's still there. He's there, but he's not there. And I really want to thank him for producing today. I want to thank Karen for working social media. And of course, Patrick Alog. Hey, listen, he wasn't a Jeopardy contestant, but he's still a winner in my books. And the Dodgers won too, right? I'm glad he was screening calls today. Did a great job. Michaela, take it away.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.